I think the Israelis now are missing the main story, which is not violence, but the real empire of the Palestinians in Israel is their general, the toxic hostility towards Israel around the world, especially.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Tobin, Editor-in-Chief of the Jewish News Syndicate, JNS.org, and you're listening to Top Story, a weekly podcast where I analyze the most important stories happening in Jewish news around the world. Each week, I will break down politics, foreign policy, and culture to provide insights into what is going on behind the headlines. Hello, and welcome to Top Story. Thanks for joining us today. We have a very timely conversation for you about the Middle East, terrorism, and diplomacy with scholar Daniel Pipes. But before we start, I want to encourage everyone to like this video and podcast, subscribe to JNS, and click on the bell for notifications. Also, we would love to hear from you. Please write to us at editor@jns.org and let us know where you listen or watch the show and what you think about it. I also want to remind you that you don't have to wait a full week for more Top Story analysis. There is a daily Top Story podcast where I share more news and analysis with you about the most significant issues we're facing today. You can find the daily show under Top Story with Jonathan Tobin on the JNS channel on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now to today's program. As far as the international media is concerned, the latest terrorist atrocities in Israel are just part of an ongoing cycle of violence. That's a phrase that is ubiquitous in describing the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. It's used specifically because it seeks to portray events there as equally the fault of both sides. That fits in with a Western and very American notion that conceives of all disputes as essentially misunderstandings and capable of being resolved by patient negotiations ending in compromises that can give both sides all they need, if not all they want. That has been the operating principle behind American diplomacy in the Middle East. Indeed, every U.S. administration of the last half century, with the conspicuous exception of that of Donald Trump, has assumed that this is the only reasonable approach to the question of how to end the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian Arabs. The idea was that a two-state solution was the only rational end goal, and the only way to achieve it was to push Israel to make concessions to the Palestinians. And if this was a mere territorial conflict, in which the drawing of borders and in which two sides could eventually agree on compromises on the various issues that they could accept, this might be correct. In such a scenario, Secretary of State Antony Blinken's call for calm from both sides in the wake of last week's Jerusalem massacre, and his efforts to ensure that Israel did nothing that might make a theoretical two-state solution less likely, would be sensible. While the Biden administration claimed it supported Israel's right to defend itself and expressed horror over the Jerusalem attacks, its statements treated Israel's efforts to root out terror cells, such as last week's operation in Jenin against Islamic Jihad, as in some ways morally equivalent to Palestinian terrorism. The problem with this approach is that it is based on a fundamental misconception about why the conflict began and how it might be ended. If the two parties were equally at fault and equally unwilling to compromise, the entire history of the conflict, which is to say the century-old Arab war against Zionism and the Jews, would be different. A more realistic approach would be to recognize that Palestinian national identity is inextricably tied up with that war on the Jews, and that this conception is the motivating force of Palestinian politics. It explains the intransigent refusal of the leading Palestinian parties, the Islamists of Hamas, who governed Gaza as an independent state in all but name, and the supposed moderates of Fatah, who run the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, to recognize the legitimacy of a Jewish state and agree to a permanent peace. It explains why terrorism and the shedding of Jewish blood is still the primary source of political credibility among Palestinian factions, as well as why the news of the murder of seven Jews outside a Jerusalem synagogue on International Holocaust Remembrance Day and the Sabbath set off a massive celebration in Palestinian cities and towns. What the United States needs to do is not only to drop the reflexive talk of a cycle of violence, but also to belatedly try to understand the cause of the conflict and to realize that it will only be ended when a sea change occurs in the political culture of the Palestinians that causes them to acknowledge defeat in their long war to eradicate Israel. Moreover, it requires American leaders to also stop pretending that this conflict isn't one about borders or settlements, but about something more fundamental about Arab and Muslim beliefs, about the rights of other peoples, like the Jews, to sovereignty in the part of the world they consider the realm of Islam. Now, to take a deep dive into these issues, we're very pleased to have with us today someone who has devoted his career to these issues and to understanding the Middle East and the Arab and Muslim world. Daniel Pipes is a historian and the leading contemporary American scholar on the Middle East. He has led the Middle East Forum think tank since its founding in 1994. He has taught at Chicago, Harvard, Pepperdine, and the U.S. Naval War College. He served in five U.S. administrations, received two presidential appointments, and has testified before many congressional committees. He's the author of 16 books on the Middle East, Islam, and other topics, as well as an author of columns that have appeared in many leading publications. Daniel Pipes, welcome to Top Story.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, thank you for coming on and taking the time to join us today, Daniel. I really appreciate it. I want to start by asking you about the latest American responses to Palestinian terrorism, and I guess whether Secretary of State Antony Blinken's call for calm from both sides is going to help rather than hurt the chances of avoiding more violence.
Let me put it in perspective. The Biden administration is perhaps the first since 30 years, since Oslo, that has not had some ambitious program to bring peace between Palestinians and Israelis. That's something that should be celebrated. But as you probably agree with me, those efforts have not been productive. Quite counterproductive. So while the Biden administration includes, I think, lots of people who are not friendly to Israel, the overall context is, in fact, friendly to Israel. Within that, who knows if the violence has been started in anticipation of the Blinken visit or just coincidental. In any case, it does put the spotlight on Palestinians rather than Iran, which is what the Israelis are going to talk about. I don't think it matters too much. Answer your question directly. I don't think it matters too much. Soothing words saying calm on all sides doesn't have much. No one will remember them. Nobody can remember.
Yeah, well, I know in the past several years, the Middle East Forum has attempted to create support for pushing for what you've called an Israeli victory in the conflict, rather than on insisting that the two sides compromise and agree to two-state solution, which, even though the Biden administration hasn't proposed, you know, a peace deal, as you rightly say, as every other administration, including that of Trump, tried to do, they're still committed to this, you know, notion of a theoretical two-state solution and trying to sort of prevent Israel from sort of winning from, you know, the war on Palestinian terror. The assumption of many people in Israel and the United States has been that conventional victory in the sense of one side winning and one side admitting defeat is impossible between Israel and the Palestinians. Why are they wrong?
It's what I call the theory of Palestinian supermen. The Germans could lose, the Japanese could lose, and many others. We could lose in Vietnam. But no, Palestinians are so radical, so determined that they can't lose. No, obviously, I don't think that's the case. Palestinians have no military strength to speak of. I'm not, it might surprise you, but I'm not against the two-state solution in the abstract. Once the Palestinians are defeated, understand the defeat, accept the Jewish state, it's okay. It's one possible solution. So I'm not against it in theory. I'm totally against it today. My perspective is that just about a century ago, with the appointment of Haji Amin al-Husseini as Mufti of Jerusalem, the Palestinians entered into a period of what I call rejectionism, absolute refusal to accept any aspect of Judaism, Zionism, subsequently Israel. So radical that there is a plausible argument that Husseini influenced Hitler in the direction of the final solution. Hitler would have been content with expelling Jews. Husseini didn't want them in Palestine. He influenced Hitler to murder the Jews. Absolute rejection. Now, 100 years later, it's not so absolute, but it's still there. That is the core of the conflict. The Palestinians will never take a yes for an answer. Anything they're given, they'll just accept and demand more until there is no Jewish state, no Jewish presence here. So that's the core of the problem, and that has to be addressed. And I would argue that there are many other ideas, schemes, plans, do not address that core, fundamental, hard thing that I'm trying to address.
Yeah, well, I know some on the left still claim that the Oslo Accords were, in a sense, an admission of Palestinian defeat. And I guess my question is, why are so many people in virtually every administration unwilling to analyze everything that happened after Oslo and admit that the concept that it proposed was flawed?
The Palestinians did formally, the person of Yasser Arafat, write and speak words of acceptance. But literally within hours of the ceremony on the White House lawn, September 13th, 1993, Arafat indicated to his radio audience that he didn't really mean it. This was just a stage towards elimination of the Jewish state. And everything he did subsequently over the next 11 years confirmed that interpretation. He was just doing what he had to do at the moment because the Soviet Union had collapsed, Saddam Hussein had lost, he was in bad straits, so he did what he had to do. In no sense was he sincere. No way did he accept the state of Israel. No way does his successor, Mahmoud Abbas, who to this day speaks of eliminating Israel.
Yeah, that is a basic fact that I think many observers just don't accept. What is the reason, do you think? I mean, ideological, just, a Western idea that, everybody's really the same. Why is it so hard for the entire U.S. foreign policy establishment, as well as the international community, to grasp, these basic facts that you've just outlined for us?
I avoided your question last time. I'll address it this time. I think it's so preposterous that someone could come to the White House lawn in that fashion, Nobel Peace Prizes and the whole works, and yet not mean it. It just doesn't make sense. Also, I would argue that the Israelis, from 1993 to roughly halfway since then, it's called 2008, themselves didn't pay attention. The Israelis were so confident. This was the beginning of economic boom. This was the beginning of the internet era. The Israelis didn't care what the Palestinians did. I summarized that 15-year period by a quote of Shimon Peres, who had many, many positions during those years, all very important, which he said, let them talk. And to some extent, he could have said, but I don't think he did, let them act. Let them do what they want. We're not going to pay attention. We, the Israelis, have decided this conflict is going to be over, and we're going to go about doing it. And who cares what the Palestinians do? It was an act of overconfidence. It was supreme overconfidence. We, the Israelis, can decide this. And the Palestinians just have to go along. And the rest of the world said, oh, okay, the Israelis are, they're okay with this. Then why should we be worried about it? But it was also the preposterousness of it. I mean, how can you do that? How can you say you can accept Israel and not do so? I did an article in 1996, I think it was called Two-Face Yasser, where I looked at his comments in English and other Western languages, and then his comments in Arabic and other Muslim majority languages, and they were startlingly different, as you would expect. It's a little bit like Brezhnev. Cold War and Civil War between us and another two Soviet subjects.
Yeah, I think you've outlined that. That's pretty clear. The failure to deal rationally with Palestinian intransigence isn't solely the fault of American or Western pressure. It's also an Israeli political problem. I think your answer is that the reason why so many Israelis cling to these illusions about Palestinian intentions is essentially arrogance. And I think, in listening to you, I was recalling, the late Yitzhak Rabin said, and indeed I heard him say it just 2 weeks before he died on his last visit to the United States, when he was interviewed by me and some other members of the Jewish press. And the familiar line that Arafat would fight Hamas and the terrorists, and he would do so without the interference of the Israeli Supreme Court. Now, obviously, Arafat had no, while the Israeli Supreme Court remains certainly a major factor inside Israel and a source of controversy, Arafat had no intention of fighting terrorism. He was actually fomenting, paying, planning terrorism himself. And while we assume Abbas is not planning terrorism, he is still fomenting it. He is still paying for it in one way or another. And yet that doesn't seem to impact, as much as certainly the majority of the Israeli electorate has moved on from the Oslo illusions, there's still a significant portion that has not. And, part of this struggle between, the left and the right continues in that way.
I would disagree and say, look at the makeup of the current Knesset. Meretz is out, Labor is 4 seats. So, and the Zionist, ignoring the Arab parties for a moment, on the Zionist side, it's, 106-4? There really is no Oslo constituency anymore. That's the fun.
I agree about that.
But I would point, and maybe this would be more controversial than saying that the Israelis are overconfident between 1993 and 2008. I would say they're overconfident in the period 2008 to 2023. If the former period was the period of Shimon Peres, the latter period, obviously, is the era of Benjamin Netanyahu. And if I quote Peres, about let them talk, my quote for the past 15 years would be from Efron Inbar, a strategist, Israeli strategist who's worked on this map. But he dismisses the Palestinians as Israeli. Clever saying, strategic nuisance. What he's getting at is that if there are, in recent years, 5, 6, 8, 10 deaths a year from violent attacks, maybe this year 20, now, that's not a large number in a population of close to 10 million. Many more traffickers. But I think the Israelis now are missing the main story, which is not violence. Yes, it's taking place, especially in the last few days. It's there. But the real impact of the Palestinians on Israel is they're generating a toxic hostility towards Israel around the world, and especially in the left. If you look at what the left doesn't like, it doesn't like how Israel treats the Palestinians, by which I mean residents of the West Bank, Gaza, and Eastern Jerusalem. This may be controversial to say, but I think there's still an overconfidence among the Israelis. If the period of 1993 to 2008 was the era of Peres and let them talk, the period 2008 to 23 is the period, obviously, of Benjamin Netanyahu. And here my quote would be not from Netanyahu, but from a well-respected, someone I admire, strategist by the name of Efraim Inbar, who calls the Palestinians a strategic nuisance. Now, what he's getting at is that the Palestinians are killing some Israelis every year. In the recent years, it's been 4, 5, 6. This year, it'll be more. But in a population of 10 million, that's something you can live with. That's fewer than the number of people die on the roads, in accidents. I disagree. I don't see the Palestinians as a strategic nuisance to Israel. I see that they are a formidable enemy, not in terms of the violence they engage in, but in terms of the hostility they generate towards Israel. The residents of Gaza, the West Bank, and Eastern Jerusalem are the center of attention of a huge number of people around the world, especially on the left, and they despise Israel. and the Palestinians have this enormous hold. This is not some obscure liberation front. This is the most favored non-state actor, and it has immense impact on Israel. Now, lately, President Boric came to office in Chile. President Lula came to office in Brazil. They both are of this disposition. Granted, not the most important two countries to Israel, but a signal that a Corbyn in the future or a Sanders type in the United States could well come to office. People who have this kind of view, even Jewish people like Sanders. So that's, I think, the great danger the Palestinians pose to Israel. That's the strategic threat, not the violence, but the enormous impact the Palestinian narrative has on well-wishing people and some not so well-wishing around the world. It's primarily on the left, but not exclusively. Tyrants tend to be, obviously, Islamists, and many other Muslims are anti-Israel. So there's a huge body of people who despise Israel and who want to do it harm because of the Palestinian nature. Not because, for example, the Iranian threat. That's not the issue. Not the internal Muslim population of Israel. That's not the issue. It's the residents of the West Bank, Gaza, and Eastern Jerusalem, known in short as Palestinians.
I think that's a very important point. And I think it is one that Israel, certainly Israelis, and even sort of the American Jewish organizations, even the many of the Zionist ones, do ignore, because they think of the UN as just a talking shop. The UN Human Rights Council as a nuisance, something that they can issue press releases denouncing, but that it doesn't have any real impact. And certainly the Israelis, as much as they get angry about that too, they also dismiss it. And in terms of their international diplomacy, spend a lot of time, talking about their various little triumphs, about an Israeli official getting some post at the UN as a sign of a victory, but don't consider things like the investigation that has been conducted, inquiry conducted by the Human Rights Council, which is sort of anti-Semitic to its core and clearly geared towards treating the creation and the existence of Israel as a crime. They don't seem to think that that has any strategic significance. So explain to us where that can lead. Why does it really present a threat to Israel that so many people are just ignoring?
Right. The general attitude among Israelis is the world needs us. It needs our medical breakthroughs. It needs our arsenal. It needs our culture. The world needs us, needs our gas. We're strong. We've got diplomatic relations, we've got trade relations, we're flourishing. I don't disagree with all that. But I would say that someone like Boric or Lula would happily dispense with Israel has to offer because they want to harm Israel. The Israelis say it hasn't done us much damage and therefore won't do us much damage. And I say, just because it hasn't so far doesn't mean it won't in the future. I do believe that this generally left-wing anti-Zionism is growing. I think it started in the early 90s. I see four events as precipitating. In 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War meant that the bilateral American-Soviet rivalry came to an end, and there was time to pay attention to other issues. 1992 was the Maastricht Treaty. It's complicated, but basically this confirmed the value of working through the European Union and working together, and led to an increase of rejection of a state like Israel and its use of violence. 1993, of course, was the Oslo Accords. In 1994, often ignored, but perhaps the most significant of all these developments, the election of Nelson Mandela to the presidency in South Africa. That meant that the apartheid issue was over. So where is the new apartheid state? And it's not completely a coincidence that this came to blossom in 2001 in Durban, South Africa. That's where the new apartheid state was designated. So this is on the increase now for some 30 years. And as I perceive it, it keeps increasing. Just a few days ago, within Grand Central Station in New York City, it was virulent. I can't remember the slogans, but they were about ending Israel, very, very specifically. This sort of thing didn't take place in past years. I think it's gone. I think the Israelis need to be cognizant of it. I think the way to deal with it is by addressing the Palestinian hostility to Israel. And I think the only way to do that is by confronting head on the Palestinian rejection of Israel. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be pleasant, but there is no alternative. Everybody else is coming up with ways to finesse this, to avoid this. And I'm saying you can't. You got to deal with it. Let me give you an illustration. Kahana. Kahana says kick them out. That's in some ways more radical than what I'm on. But say the Israelis do kick out. Say they kick out every last Muslim from Israel and the West Bank and Gaza and whatever else. Say they just the pure, you know, ultimate Kahana solution. Exactly how is that going to solve this problem? Yeah, it would solve the problem. I think it's not going to solve the problem. It's still the idea would transform it. So many more people would be anti-Zionist than not today. It's a fool's errand. You can't do that. Annexation, what does that do? It doesn't achieve anything. It's purely symbolic, but it has a lot of people riled up.
Well, I think, you know, you're pointing towards something that has been sort of a debate sort of beneath the surface about within the pro-Israel community, which is how concerned to be about the BDS movement and the rise of the intersectional left to a position of real influence within the Democratic Party. A lot of sort of mainstream liberal Democrats say, you know, don't pay attention to the squad, you know, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and their many allies, now growing number of allies in Congress, saying they don't represent the mainstream. Biden and Blinken are the mainstream. And yet, you know, the intersectional left controls academia. It has a powerful voices within the media, certainly has a toehold in popular culture. That could really have an impact on the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship, couldn't it? It's not purely theoretical. It's not just a matter of the fact that the BDS movement hasn't laid a glove on the Israeli, you know, first world economy, but that there is a genuine threat to political support, even in the United States, let alone Europe or anywhere else.
And I would note that President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken are far older than Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and their ilk. This is the future. The younger ones are the future of the party, and they are far more hostile as an aggregate than the older ones. And indeed, all polling shows, and especially on the Democratic side, by age, you see almost linear progression from the most friendly being the oldest and the least friendly being the youngest. Yeah, it's in the culture, and they're going to come to power with these days. No, they didn't. Not yet, but I think it's in the cards. And Israel is ignoring this. It is, I believe, analogous to the way Israel is ignoring, or Israelis were ignoring the Palestinian actions in the Paris period. They're ignoring this in the Netanyahu period. And I think it needs to be addressed. It is the foremost threat that Israel faces. It is the threat, besides, of course, the nuclear weapons. But that's a completely different issue that you and I have no say in.
Yeah, I think the chain. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, we there's nothing we can do about the Iranian nuclear. There's a lot we can do about this delegitimization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get to Iran in a couple of minutes. I think that, you know, the sort of the counter argument from the left is that by focusing on the intersectional left and its, you know, its attitudes towards Israel, Israel becomes a partisan issue. It seems to be looking at it from the wrong point of view, but there is this notion of sort of Israel being regarded as a red state, and that blue state America, you know, regards it as increasingly alien. You know, that plays into the debates about the new government in Israel. And indeed, it plays into alienation among American Jews towards Israel, because the majority of American Jews are very much, you know, where they live, they're blue staters. The you know, vast majority of them are still voting for the Democrats and are liberal politically, and regard as sort of a nationalist, you know, religious majority in Israel, and one that, as you rightly say, rejects, you know, Oslo as a failed paradigm, with some, you know, with good deal of alienation. It's very hard to overcome these attitudes and to try and shake people out of their illusions about these ideas, aren't they? Isn't it?
Indeed, I would point to there being some Jewish elements who subscribe to this radical design. It's a Jewish voice for peace, would be one example. But they're a pretty small, marginal element. I think far more important in the case of Jews who pay attention to what's going on in Israel is something like the grandfather clause with the right of return, the law of return, and what's happening at the Western Wall and so forth. So I don't think that's really about the Palestinians. That's more internal, you know, the role of the Supreme Court and other such internal matters. I think most of the world doesn't follow what's going on with the Western Wall. Most of the world, insofar as it cares about Israel, either sees Israel as a blessing unto the nations or sees it as the new apartheid state that is more awful than any other state, including North Korea, on the surface of the earth. We don't really know a whole lot of Islam elements. We just follow one narrative or the other.
You know, sort of the counter, you know, sort of the optimistic events of the last few years, you know, focuses on the Abraham Accords, which represented a genuine achievement on the part of, you know, the Trump administration to achieve a breakthrough towards a wider normalization of relations between Israel, the Arab and Muslim world. It happened because, at least for a short time, the U.S. gave up its obsessive focus on the Israel-Palestinian peace agreement. That doesn't seem like it's going to happen, and realized that many in the Arab world were sick of being held hostage by Palestinian intransigence. As someone who really understands the Muslim and Arab world, do you see the spirit of those accords spreading in the Arab, or is it the rampant anti-Semitism there as strong as ever, despite the desire of some Arab states and their governments, you know, largely authoritarian or you know, monarchical rulers, to embrace a good relationship?
I have a two-part answer. Part one is to argue that the Arab states were at war with Israel for a very conveniently remembered 25-year period from 1948 to 1973. It was war. It was tanks and planes. Was war. After 1973 to today, conveniently 50 years, the Arab states have tiptoed away. Other than two hostilities, 1982 between Syria and Israel, 1991 Iraq and Israel, both minor and both very much lost by the Arab states, the Arab states have walked away. They talk, they clamor, but they don't actually go to war. They've been gone. Nobody seemed to notice, but they've been gone twice as long as they were engaged. They won out. The Arab states saw Israel as a vehicle for their own purposes. But once they unleashed it, in particular Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 1950s and 60s, they could no longer ride that tiger. They didn't like it. And indeed, to this day, they worry about the anti-Zionism that they had stirred up long, long ago, and they try and tap it down. In their stead, shortly after 1973, came the Palestinians, who are far more determined and far more radical than the Arab states and far more sympathetic to the outside world. Basically, nobody bought Nasser's and others' line that they were the victims of Israel. Pretty implausible. Look at a map of the Middle East. But if you look at a map of the Israelis and the Palestinians, it is plausible. So the Palestinians have replaced the Arab states. My second answer would be, the Abraham Accords are great, great, and may they flourish and grow and extend. But they have next to no impact whatsoever on what I was talking about earlier, about the anti-Zionism on the left. If you care about the Palestinians, if that's your focus, if you think you care about them, then what the United Arab Emirates do, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco do, has no relevance at all. None. And so while the Abraham Accords are great in themselves, they're irrelevant to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which is what I consider to be a strategic threat to Israel, along with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I want to get back to the Abraham Accords in a minute. Let me go back to the, what you've just referred to in this international campaign against Israel, which is, far as we both believe, far more virulent and far more dangerous than many Israelis seem to believe. The question is, what can if they did wake up to it, what can they do about it? They're clearly outvoted at the United Nations, the UN Human Rights Council. There's no persuading, you know, the so-called human rights community, people in Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. You know, they're all, you know, dedicated anti-Zionists. They view Israel's creation as a crime. It's continuing everything it does as a crime. What does Israel do about this, you know, strong international force against it?
Can't do anything. They're there. But my basic argument is that it's harder to be more Catholic than the Pope. If the Palestinians acquiesce, accept that their 100-year-long battle has failed, then others eventually will come. So my Israel is fortunate in that its primary enemy is so weak, small in population, trivial in economic and military force. The Israelis have an enormous number of tools at their disposal, obviously military tools, police tools, economic tools, but also other ones, cultural, religious, legal, and so forth. So it's my belief that if the Israelis decide that their goal is to break this Palestinian rejectionism and rally their strength to do so, they can, but they're not trying to. So that right now, there is no policy. The closest thing one has is mow the lawn, beat Hamas so badly that they stay quiet for a few days. No, I would like the Israelis to adopt a policy that the residents of Gaza, West Bank, and Eastern Jerusalem understand that Israel is there, is permanent, is rich, is tough, is determined, and they have no chance. It's futile. You don't want your children to go off and blow themselves up because it serves no purpose. You just lost a child. You haven't furthered the goal of the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Switching back to sort of the Arab states, do you think Saudi Arabia, which is the focus of a lot of expectation from the pro-Israel community, will ever normalize relations with Israel? Or even after, say, an American administration comes in and is more interested in this idea than certainly the Biden administration appears to be? Or does its status as the guardian of the Muslim holy places, will that always prevent it from complete normalization from Israel?
Let's be imaginative. Let's flip that on its head. If you're guardian of two holy places, wouldn't you like to be guardian of three holy places? How about the Israelis approach the Saudis and say, hey, we've got something you might want to talk about. We don't like the Palestinians, and we don't like the Jordanians, by the way, either, being in charge of the Temple Mount. How about you? Wouldn't you like to add that to your portfolio? Let's talk. Let's talk about diplomatic relations. Let's talk about ending the status quo. I don't know what the details might be, but hey, the Israelis have all these strengths that they don't make use of. And that's certainly one of them. There are five competitors on the Muslim side for control of the Temple Mount, the three I mentioned, Palestinians, Jordanians, Saudis, also the Turks, and also the Moroccans. Why not exploit that?
That's an interesting idea. Would the Saudis be, do you think, more interested in preserving peace than, say, the Jordanians, which, the Jordanian regime, King Abdullah probably doesn't want any problems with Israel, but he's just as if not more, he's maybe dependent on Israel in some ways, but he's very afraid of the Palestinians and public opinion in his country, which is majority Palestinian Arab. Would the Saudis do a better job, you think, of keeping the peace and or even possibly allowing sort of a less discriminatory policy on the Temple Mount?
Abdullah is terrified of his shadow. He's so weak. I don't think MBS is Mohammed bin Salman. I think he's ambitious and would welcome taking this on. Right. Speculation on my part, but those are two very different leaders.
That's and MBS true.
Would love to play ball and find some way to extend his influence. What could be grander from the Wahhabi Saudi point of view than to gain control, Islamic control, not sovereignty, Islamic control over the Temple Mount?
Well, I think that's one of the best original ideas we've heard on this podcast. Let me ask you now about Iran. It is the leading Muslim power championing the war against Israel. It rejected the Biden administration's best efforts to resume the Obama policy of appeasement and is now embroiled in repressing a populist revolt against its theocratic regime and is also now involved in Russia's war in Ukraine. Do you believe the Iranian regime can survive all of this? And is its influence in the region ebbing, or is it still a very potent force through its terrorist auxiliaries?
You gave a great review, but you missed one thing, which is that Khamenei is sick and could be gone any day. And that could enormously influence the future of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The protests have been powerful, more powerful than any of the preceding ones. They will not lead to an overthrow of the government, but they have led to a sense of strength and determination not to live under this theocratic rule. Every time the government bats down an insurrection of this sort, it's weaker, but it's still there. And the insurrection needs leadership. And by the way, the Palestinians were very significant in supporting Khomeini back 45 years ago. There has been no comparable Israeli help to the opposition, at least that I know of. Where are the Israelis? How come they aren't helping the opposition? Where are we, the Americans? Anyway, the Israelis in particular, where are they? Until there is leadership like Khomeini provided, that everyone can get behind, it's, I think, a bit futile. That said, the Iranian regime is weak, weak economically, weak in terms of internal support, weak in terms of Khamenei perhaps dying any day, and in particular weak because of the new alliance with Russia. It's been very striking to me that so many actors on this world stage, and particularly Europeans, who shrug at Iranian activities, not just vis-a-vis Israel, but Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, and Yemen, and Lebanon, and Syria, they really get excited about Ukraine. Finally, there's something that got their attention. Okay, well, I'll take it. It's a bit odd, but none of the other places count. But all right, I'll take it. You know, a lot more people are upset about Iranian activities thanks to the drones that are slamming into Ukrainian hospitals. Good. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about Ukraine, but before I do, Middle East Forum has been a leader in trying to focus public attention on what Qatar is doing in the Middle East, in essence, taking over the role that the Saudis used to have as the primary funders of Islamist fundamentalism around the world, funding terrorism. Qatar still seems to have this, you know, equivocal role in that it's the ally of Iran and of terrorists, but it still has relations with the United States and hosts, you know, the World Cup, of soccer. We don't seem to have made that much progress in, you know, other than in the fact that I don't think Jewish leaders are going there on junkets anymore. Qatar still seems to have maintained its status and its ability to sort of be on both sides of the international equation. Where is that going?
American Jewish leaders may not be going to Qatar on junkets, but Israeli soccer fans are going there went there in the thousands. The countries have been very clever. It's a tiny country. When you just take the subjects of the ruler, you're at 300,000, 10% of the total population, roughly. And yet they have this very sophisticated policy going back now close to 30 years of playing off all the different sides. I remember a joke from the 1990s of which are the three great powers, Russia, America, and Qatar, way back then. They have used their phenomenal amount of money to good effect, and they get away with a great deal. We have been, as you say, working hard on this in particular, not so much myself, but my colleague, Greg Roman. We've been looking at their charitable donations. We've been looking at their World Cup activities and the like. And it's roughly analogous to the Saudis in the old days. I mean, it's the other Wahhabi state. And they just have masked it as, well, better than the Saudis did. And they're getting away with it. I hope that by continued research and by making this information public, more and more people understand, particularly Americans, but around the world, the nefarious role of the Qatari state in Islamization or Islamism, in economics, in politics, diplomacy, funding violent jihad, and so on.
Turning our eyes sort of a broader lens outside of the Middle East, you already referenced Ukraine. The Biden administration is treating the war in Ukraine as its number one foreign policy and defense priority. What's your opinion about America's role in this war? And do you believe that the focus on Ukrainian territorial integrity, victory for Kyiv, as opposed to victory for Israel over Putin and the Russian regime, assuming that, you know, that victory there is achievable in the same way that victory for Israel is the only way to end the Middle East conflict. Where do you see this heading? And do you think this, in, you know, and as well as factoring in the pressure on Israel to join the conflict in one way or the other?
I'm all in for Ukraine. And I approve of the Biden administration. I'll go a step or two further. I'm ready to send them fighter jets. I'm glad we're now about to send them tanks. This is crucial. Ukraine has a long and tortured history, but for me, the current era began almost exactly a year ago, and that's what we should focus on, not the sins and problems of Ukraine historically. And I don't worry about corruption. Yeah, of course, you send over billions and billions, there'll be some corruption. But from the American point of view, this is peanuts, this is pennies. This is absolutely crucial. Concerning Israel, I think one has to understand that Israel is in a bind and has concerns about the Jewish population of Russia, has concerns about the Russian domination of the Syrian airspace, and has to tread carefully. Understood. We can't be all in the way that we can be, and the Poles can be, and the British can be. I understand that. They should do their best, keeping in mind that they have to maintain open lines to Moscow.
Do you see Russia, especially in the wake of its, you know, the rather dismal performance of its military, do you see it as the as much of a geopolitical threat as perhaps we would have a year ago before, you know, its invasion didn't go so well? And how does that factor into this discussion?
No, it certainly is not the same threat that it was then. It's been astonishing that almost every single decision that Putin has made has turned out badly. Everything. NATO is stronger. Ukraine is much more of a country. His own economy is much weaker. He's lost so many people, skilled people, and so forth and so on. I see long-term the prospect of Russia becoming a virtual satellite of China. Russia needs China. The Chinese are going to drive a hard bargain, and they're going to get a lot from it. So I see this in the context of the really serious international rivalry, which is the United States and China, and this is to China's benefit.
Do you see that becoming more likely if Ukraine actually wins something approximating, you know, an actual victory over Russia? You know, it's not clear to me how either side ultimately wins or loses at this point. Seems somewhat of a stalemate. Does China profit from this one way or the other?
I think whatever happens, or put it just this way, the worse Russia does, the more China gains.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a daunting thought. Your focus is primarily on educating, and has been on educating Americans about foreign policy issues. I think that's always been a heavy lift in a nation that is not always that interested in the rest of the world. Today, outside of Ukraine, I am not always on Ukraine. I think both major parties are less interested in foreign policy than ever. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about America's role in the world and whether it will be able to continue to defend its interests and values abroad?
We Americans, and more broadly Westerners, have been quite blasé, particularly since the collapse of the Soviet Union. We prevailed. There's no real threat. And it will take something to shake us. Ukraine has shaken a lot of people. If you put aside the horrible humanitarian aspect of it, strategically, it's a great gift. Sweden and Finland are obvious examples, but more broadly, the West has woken up to the fact that real wars can still take place. It's not always us against some little force in Somalia. Real wars can take place. And I think that has woken some people up, but I don't know if it's enough. I think there's a certain attitude of overconfidence that we are so strong, we can do what we want. The Chinese, the aggressiveness of the Chinese is helpful in waking Westerners up. But I don't know. It's still, I think, an open question whether we will wake up enough or not. I've been heartened to see that, particularly in the case of Ukraine, the Democrats have been very strong. Indeed, they've been stronger than the Republicans. Not been heartened by the Republican response so much, but very heartened by the Democrats. That the party that for so many decades after Vietnam was essentially weak on defense policy is now the stronger of the two parties. And probably the stronger of the two parties vis-a-vis China as well. And certainly vis-a-vis Turkey. So here are three important countries where Democrats are standing tougher than the Republicans. That's a big surprise.
Well, I think in the case of Ukraine, they may have a lot to do with the ideas about Trump and Russia collusion and the Trump impeachment. But I think you're certainly right. The Democrats seem more.
May I just reverse that?
Republicans.
May I reverse that? I don't think it's about the impeachment so much as the fact that Putin has appealed to conservatives. In the notorious words of Tucker Carlson, Vladimir Putin never called me a racist. There's an admiration on the part of some conservatives for Putin, standing out for good old traditional values. I think that's more the appeal than what you alluded to. I think the Republicans are weaker because they don't like the Democrats who are in power now and feel some sympathy for Putin.
Well, those are, we'll see how this plays out. Clearly, we have a couple more years until we have a chance for one different administration, different approach. We'll see who's supporting wars then. Daniel, thanks so much for coming on today and for your insights on these very important issues. We also want to thank our audience. Please remember to tune in every day for Top Story Daily Edition. Whether you're listening to us on Spotify or any of the other podcast platforms, or watching us live on Facebook or Twitter, or on the JNS YouTube channel or on JBS TV. Please like and or subscribe to Top Story, click on the bell for notifications, and give us good reviews. Please write to us at editor@jns.org and let us know where you listen or watch the show and what you think about it. And remember, keep reading and thinking for yourself, and we'll see you again next week.